Welcome to the Wheel With It podcast with your host, Devin Wieters. We're a community that is committed to celebrating diversity and inclusion, providing and promoting disability education and awareness, and having fun too. Remember to rate and review the podcast and enjoy the show.
Hello, hello. My name is Devin Wieters. Welcome to another episode of Wheel With It. Today we have Cedric Bridgeforth as our guest. He was a really cool guy. I really enjoyed this interview. And even though it's short, I think you will too. Enjoy the episode. Hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of Wheel With It. Today I am here with Cedric Bridgeforth. Cedric, how are you today?
I'm doing great, and thank you for having me.
You are so welcome. But first of all, tell us about yourself, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, perfect. I was born and raised in rural North Alabama and lived there growing up. Served 4 years in the Air Force, went back to Alabama for a few years, attended college, graduated, moved to Southern California, became an ordained minister in the United Methodist Church, and have served there within the church in a variety of capacities since then, and currently reside in Los Angeles, California.
Well, how did you decide to become a minister, and what was like the seminary process?
Yeah, deciding, that's an odd question that I get, and it's still, after all these years, it's like, that's a tough one to answer, but I know the first time I had any thoughts about it, I was 9, 10 years old in my church back home, and I had prayed this prayer as part of our regular youth day program, and my grandmother came up after I'd finished. She came and she grabbed me, and she grabbed both sides of my face, and she said, "Boy, I'm so proud of you. One day you're going to preach." And I started screaming, and I ran out of the church. I was screaming, I don't want to preach. And so that was where it began, and just continuing through my teenage years, there was always affirmation of my leadership skills, my connection with people. I had a desire to be of service to others, and really felt at home in the church environment. And then as far as the seminary experience, it's what got me from Alabama to Southern California. I chose a seminary that was known to be more theologically progressive by many and very academic, because at the time I was considering getting my PhD in New Testament and teaching as my form of ministry, as opposed to going into any type of pastoral ministry. So it was a time of just study of Bible, of worship, church history, how people communicate and congregate, and what to do when that doesn't go well. So all of that was a part of that process.
So what did you learn about what to do when people don't get along?
Yeah, it wasn't much different from what my grandparents and my parents taught us growing up. It's to listen, really listen well, and try to get to the heart of what it is people need, as opposed to just zeroing in on what they say or what it is they say they want. But really pay attention to what they need and try to understand why that's important to other people, and help all those involved in the conflict or in the disagreement or the situation to do the same, do it for themselves, to do it for others, and to be able to find a way to empathize, if not in whole, at least in part, so that there can be a restoration or continuation of relationship.
How has the past few years been for you as a preacher with all the tension around it, around everything?
Yeah, I guess the everything you mean is everything, right?
Yes.
Our geopolitical realities permeate their way into Thanksgiving conversations. They permeate their way into what pastors or ministers say in their sermons. It's in the ways in which people gather when they can gather, either online or in person. And so it's really just been interesting to watch my colleagues try to walk that fine line to hold their congregations together, to find those things that they share in common, help them see that in each other, be able to name what they value about being together first and foremost, but also make space for people to be able to name where they are and where they're struggling, and not to dismiss or dehumanize people, but to really try to humanize, listen, again, get to that deeper need, that value, and find ways to keep people engaged in relationship and in conversation. It's really hard because some people dig in and they don't want to move. Their intention is to stay right where they are, or to bully you until you come to the place where they are. And for me, it's really been a commitment to be clear about who I am, continue to communicate that, but to stay open to hearing what I can and doing what I can to bring other people together. But then also to see what are my growing edges. And I see that in a lot of my colleagues as well. It's like, where do we need to grow and where are we stuck as well? So that's kind of what I've seen.
So how did your church pivot during the pandemic, and how did that go?
Oh, wow. Yeah, I was actually in a pastoral role serving a church as a pastor when the pandemic started. And we immediately stopped in-person everything, hopped on Zoom. Thankfully, I understood how Zoom worked. And we created old-fashioned phone trees and whatnot to make sure everybody got the communication of how to get to us. We set up our YouTube channel, our Facebook page, updated our website. We got everything like up and ready to go in about 72 hours. And so throughout the pandemic, week to week, we learned more, the equipment we needed. We learned more, the skills we needed to strengthen other people to bring onto the team. And week over week, what we started to see was greater participation by way of our week-to-week numbers, and also people who had typically come like maybe once a month or every other month. We started seeing people participating in weekly worship more often. So every week, we saw our Bible study, small group, even our administrative meetings, drew more people. I think it's because people just couldn't go anywhere. They didn't have anything else to do. Yeah, everything was closed. So, hey, the church is gathering. We'll go see what they're doing. We'll hop online and see what they're doing. We did have the same Zoom account for everything. So you only needed to click one thing anytime to get in there. So we made it very easy for people to find us. In fact, for the first about 3 to 4 weeks when we went online, because we thought we might be online for a month and a half or whatever. So we just we created a Zoom link that was the social link, and it was always open. We left it open 24/7. So you could just pop in there and see if anybody was there, and you could just talk or pray together or whatever. And every time I hopped in there, there were people there. Sometimes people were there talking, they were watching the same show and they're talking about the show while it's on. So it became a meeting place for people. So we tried to do as much as possible to create ways for people to connect, even though they were separated and in their homes. And that was more than we were doing prior to the pandemic.
Yeah, I think a lot of churches had to luckily my church already had a good online presence, but a lot of churches are like, what are we doing? So tell me about, you were also gay, right?
That is correct.
Tell me about what it's like being a gay pastor, because that sounds very interesting to me.
That's all I know. So I can't tell you about being any other guy, but it is part of my identity. And I think one way to get to answer that question is just to say that growing up where I did, and then the time when I did, and in the family that I grew up in, I think I was more aware of my gayness long before I was aware of my Blackness. But now I find in these current times and in the context where I live, work, play, and serve, that I tend to lead more from my Blackness, more so than my queerness or my gayness. And I find myself dealing more with racial issues and concepts and constructs and trying to get greater movement on in that arena, more so than I do around the LGBT pieces, because one, I believe they are related. I believe all forms of oppression are related, whether we're talking about homophobia, xenophobia, racism, sexism, ageism, all of it, ableism. I think it all comes from a deep-rooted, wounded, sick, hurtful, harmful place. And so I think addressing any of them can help us make movement on all of them. But since my presenting identity is that of Black and male, I tend to lean more into that space. Not that I hide my queerness. There's no way for me to do that. Nor would I return to a time when I did that. But I try to present a holistic sense of my ministry. And it's really about helping people figure out what their calling, what their giftings are, and find ways for them to be the best that they can be at whatever it is they feel they're supposed to do in the world. And help people see me as and see themselves just as human beings trying to figure it out. And though there are parts of our identities that are sometimes hard to claim, affirm, and even share, that can be overcome in community. It can be overcome with a lot of therapy, I might add, but can be overcome with—
We love therapy around here.
We love it. We live for it. Everybody needs a therapist on speed dial. You heard it here first. And I think just getting people to do that has just opened a lot of doors for me and allowed me into spaces that I think if I led more from an activist perspective, which some of my colleagues do, I don't know that I would have moved as freely as I have.
That's a good answer. We can cut this out if you want me to cut it out, but just for my own personal thing, can you give me some examples of racism you've encountered recently, if there are any?
Sure. Yeah, and we don't have to cut it out. Yeah, we don't have to do that. But yeah, I tell people I grew up in rural North Alabama, and I lead with that for a reason. One, I'm proud of that. And I now live in Los Angeles, right in the heart of Los Angeles. And I can say hands down that I find Los Angeles to be more segregated and to have more race-based policies and practices than I ever recall in my formative years in rural North Alabama. It's everywhere. And it's hard to describe sometimes because it's just a part of the air that we breathe, just with the way the economy is established and who gets what and where people can afford to live or get to live, offices people get to hold or not. I find here it's a lot of it is along racial lines. And I would not have expected that prior to living here. But now that I've lived here almost 25 years, I see it all over the place. Now, personally, I have to just say that for me, the racism that I see and experience is more systemic. It's less personal. It's less directed to me, at me. Like, people aren't using racial, you know, slurs or epithets related to me, but just moving in the space, it's there.
Okay, so it's not personal. It's more like systemic, I guess.
For me. Now, I have friends, family, colleagues, neighbors who have very different experiences. And so I don't want to place that in this conversation in that way and have anybody walk away and say, oh, this is all systemic. But no, for me, my experiences are more cultural and broader than anyone doing anything in particular.
So what do you think is we would need to do to solve systemic racism?
I think some of the things that are out there of dealing with implicit bias, really getting in touch with that and stop rolling our eyes whenever we hear it and find a way to get outside of this conservative, Republican, white male dominated rhetoric around the critical race theory, and that anytime we talk about race, we're making people feel bad, so we shouldn't talk about it. If anybody feels anything when we talk about race or racism, that's a reason to talk about it so that we can unearth it, we can address it, we can heal the harm and begin to move forward collectively, pretending that the feelings or even the effects of racism, no matter how it came to be, if that exists and anyone is able to name it as their reality, then for me, that's a clarion call for all of us to stop what we're doing and pay attention, join together and address it. So I think getting in touch with our own biases, even people of color, naming how we perpetuate whiteness and white privilege and how we perpetuate systems that dominate, that position one cultural value over another, and begin to remove those things from our vocabularies, remove them from our policies, remove them from our behaviors as well.
That sounds like a perfect way to segue into our final questions. Are you ready, or is there anything you would like to add?
Oh, no, I'm loving the conversation.
Fill in the blank. Inclusion is?
Inclusion is finding space where voices and perspectives are welcomed and affirmed, even if they are different.
That is an amazing answer. What has you hopeful right now?
That's interesting. Somebody asked me this question about 2 weeks ago. It was in a panel with other ministers and nonprofit leaders. And my answer came because of the context I was in, but I'll share the same answer. For me, what gives me hope is that there are still people each and every day waking up and praying prayers, meditating, calling out to the great divine, the higher power, the universe for answers to today's problems and placing themselves in positions to receive guidance, help, support, to do whatever they can to one, live into their own purpose, but also to move the world to a better existence than what we currently experience.
And one of my favorite TV shows ever is Survivor. So do you watch Survivor?
I used to, but I stopped because I didn't like how they always treated the...
I think they've gotten better about that now. So you might want to start watching it again.
Oh, so you noticed it too, see?
They've gotten way better about it now. Like, I didn't notice it until it started being talked about, honestly, because... And this comes from somebody who wants to be on the production team of the show. So no shade to anybody on that works on the show. But I didn't notice it until they started talking about it. And then I saw how much better it got with the new diversity policy. Like, even the way the just people in general on there acted toward each other, and I was like, okay, yeah, it was bad there for a second, but yeah, they've gotten way better now. Thank you for being here today. Where can people find you on social media?
Yeah, all my social handles are Cedric Bridgeforth, and my website, cedricbridgeforth.com. I'm out there.
Okay, we will see you guys next episode. Thank you guys for listening. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Wheel With It. You can support the show by visiting our website, wheelwithit.com, following us on social media, and financially supporting us. You can find all those links in the show notes. See you next time.